You have your workbook with you. We're going to conclude this session with page 38. Page 38. Actually, the second session will be concluding. But that's where we'll be as we kind of wrap all of this up today and we finish our time together. Is the projector on? No, it's showing up on the screen. Well, if it's not the microphone not working, it's the projector, but we'll get it sooner or later. Thank you very much, Rick. I assume that will come on in just a moment. How many of you have heard people in the world, and even brethren, when they refer to marriage, talk about it as a contract? You hear people talk about the marriage contract? Let me see your hands. I hear that all the time, and it particularly bothers me when brethren use that term, because whenever the Bible talks about marriage in this regard, it doesn't use the word contract, but instead it uses the word covenant. And that's important for us to understand, the difference between a contract and a covenant. In fact, in Malachi chapter 2 and verse 14, the writer says, "She is thy companion and the wife of thy," not contract, but covenant. And in Proverbs 2, 16 and 17, Solomon warns, "Deliver thee from the strange woman that forsaketh the friend of her youth," a reference to her husband, "and forgetteth the covenant of her God." So what exactly is a covenant, and how is it different than a contract? Well, let's look first at the very definition of the Hebrew word. The Hebrew word actually goes back to the idea of the sense of cutting, or a compact made by passing between pieces of flesh. And it actually goes back to God's covenant with Abraham in Genesis chapter 15. Listen carefully. Genesis chapter 15 and verse 9. "And God took selected sacrifices and divided them in the midst. And it came to pass that when the sun went down and it was dark, behold, there was a smoking furnace and a burning lamp that passed between those pieces. In the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram." Same thing happened in Jeremiah 34 when he reestablished the covenant with them after they came back from bondage. If I understand this correctly, what's happening is you actually would dismember the sacrifice, and then you would walk between the different pieces of the sacrifice. Then you would take those pieces together, put them up on the altar, and stand before God and make a commitment, make a vow, and actually in this case, worship God in a solemn ceremony. And that was what was involved in the Abrahamic covenant. Reminds me of Song of Solomon 8 and verse 16, where it talks about setting a seal upon your heart. It's very important that we recognize that the marriage covenant in God's plan is to be sacred because, as we well know, God joins us together in heaven. And what God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. I like to think of marriage as being a triune, if it's understood properly, and not just a human duet. You know, our forefathers that began the traditions associated with weddings understood well that marriage is a spiritual covenant, and most of the traditions associated, even with our modern-day weddings, go back to this particular origin. Unfortunately, over time, in our secular culture, most of the spiritual origins of what these things originally were supposed to represent have been lost. At least that was true for me until 1994, when I was doing some preparation for my marriage and family class at Florida College, and I ran across a fascinating, well-documented piece of literature called The True Significance of the Wedding Covenant. And in this, he points out what these things were designed to mean. And for me, it just opened up an entire new vista of appreciation and understanding about what happens in a marriage and in our weddings. I understand why our secular culture has dropped out the spiritual aspect. I think it's unfortunate that oftentimes our brethren, whether we realize it or not, has lost the spiritual aspect of a wedding as well. And so with that in mind, I want us to talk a little bit tonight about the distinction between a covenant and a contract and explain to you the symbolism behind the wedding ceremony. Proverbs 20 and verse 25 says, "It is a snare to rashly say it is holy, and then later to make inquiry." So it's the devil's snare that caused people to get married for better, for worse, but not for long. Which is what folks used to say about marriages in Hollywood, and now it seems to be true of so many marriages everywhere. In 2011, approximately 30% of the divorces occurred within marriages that had occurred within the past 24 months. Do you realize what that means? That you've got about a third of the divorces that don't even last 2 years. After 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, couples are saying, "Oops, made a mistake, shouldn't have done that." And they want to back out from this holy, sacred covenant that they have entered into. No wonder that is the devil's snare, not to take their covenant relationship more seriously. One of the things we need to understand about a covenant is that a covenant is based upon trust. Well, a contract, by its very nature, is based upon distrust. And of course, that's really the way it is, and that's one of the reasons why, here it is, that's one of the reasons why in our culture, more and more, people are getting prenuptial agreements. The idea is, I'm afraid that you're going to take advantage of me, and I'm not really expecting this to last, and so when it breaks up, I want to make sure I protect my assets. And some of these prenuptial agreements are just amazing to me. It says, once limited to celebrities, the prenup is becoming routine among many couples, according to 80% of divorce attorneys surveyed this year by the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. The surge comes from couples in their second marriages as well as other singles, etc., etc. But listen to this. It says, actress Catherine Zeta-Jones, for example, reportedly reached a prenuptial agreement with Michael Douglas that pays her $5 million each time he's unfaithful to her. Could you imagine meeting in a room with the person that you're going to marry and you decide up front that you're probably not going to be faithful to me, but I'm telling you, if I catch you, it's going to cost you. And every time I catch you with another woman, you got to pay me $5 million. And the person says, okay, write it down. Could you imagine going to the altar with that kind of understanding? How ridiculous is that? I tell couples, look, if you are that afraid that this person is someone that you can't trust, my suggestion is, don't marry them. I mean, the very basis of a good marriage ought to be based upon love and faith and trust. And if that isn't there, then you can't have a covenant relationship the way God intended. Just like spiritually, it's supposed to be based upon love and faith and trust in God, right? Same thing is true with marriage. Well, contracts, the whole concept is based upon, I need to somehow or other limit my losses. I need to protect myself from liability. Most of us are experienced with what's involved in purchasing a home and a real estate contract. And typically, in a real estate contract, you put up an earnest money deposit. And usually, if you decide to back out and you change your mind, usually all that's at risk is the deposit. You might get sued for specific performance, but this normally doesn't happen. And sometimes the contract actually says that your liability is limited by this deposit. So if somebody puts up a small deposit, they're not very serious. I mean, we understand that. And the whole basis of the contract is to try to protect yourself from liability. That's why you, okay, I'll sign this, but first I want my legal counsel to look over it. And I want to go ahead and, you know, read the fine print, and I want to make sure that everything's in order because this is an arm's length transaction, and I don't really know or trust this other person. That's the way it is in the business world, and that's the whole basis, really, of contracts. please don't view Mary in that marriage in that regard. Obviously, marriage ought to be a covenant based upon trust rather than a contract that is based upon distrust. Secondly, a covenant, by its nature, lends itself to the idea of unlimited responsibility, while a contract involves, as we just said, limiting your responsibility, limiting your liability. Of course, the ultimate covenant in the Bible is the Abrahamic covenant, and where God promised the family of Abraham in about 2000 BC that through his seed all the nations of the earth would be blessed. And so much of the Old Testament is about God remembering his covenant and being faithful to work through the family of Abraham and ultimately the Israelites. But constantly the Israelites forgot about God and their relationship with him. And so he goes through unbelievable lengths working with these rebellious people to make sure that he keeps his word. It's an unbelievable description of what's involved in unlimited responsibility. Marriage is supposed to have that aspect to it because it's a covenant. That's why traditionally you take somebody for better or for worse, richer or poorer, in sickness and in health. How different is that than some of the watered-down wedding vows that I have witnessed over the last number of years? I mean, my wife and I went to a marriage of one of relatives on her side, I might add. But at any rate, we went to this wedding, and God was hardly mentioned. And in the vows, they said, "We vow to stay together as long as we continue to make each other laugh." And some people around me were kind of going, "Oh," and I'm going, "You got to be kidding me. I'm going to stay with you until your jokes get stale. I mean, what is this?" It's just the most ridiculous, watered-down, thing I've ever heard. And frequently, you'll find that the vows will say something like this in a modern-day secular wedding. They'll say, "We promise to stay together as long as we continue to meet each other's needs." And again, I've sat in audiences, and people around them are kind of going like this, and I'm just, once again, about ready to gag. Do you realize what that means? They have turned that wedding into a cost-benefit analysis. As long as I get from you what I plan to get from you and what I think I deserve, then I'll stay with you. But if I don't think this relationship is fair and I'm having to pull more of my weight than I really want to, I'm out of here. Do you realize what that is? You have turned marriage into something that's based upon selfishness and what you get out of it, instead of what the Bible says it's supposed to be based on, and that's agape love, which means you're willing to be selfless toward the person that you love. No wonder the average marriage in America only lasts 7 years. It's based upon selfishness, not selflessness. You enter into the relationship oftentimes with distrust. You don't have any level of commitment. You say, "Well, we'll get married. If it doesn't work out, we can always get divorced." What kind of ridiculousness is that? No wonder in our culture we have lost the whole concept of what it means to enter into a covenant. And this is such an important principle when we think about marriage. A covenant is designed to be lifelong. It is designed not to be broken, of course, until death. While a contract can be voided by mutual consent. If John Kilgore and I decide to go into business together, and after a while we say, you know, this isn't working out, and I say, I agree, why don't we just forget it? Okay, we just rip up the agreement, shake hands, and it's over. You can void a contract between two people without really any long-term circumstances. Oh, we just kind of have irreconcilable differences, and we just sort of move on. You see why our culture wants to talk about marriage as a contract? That's the way they kind of view marriage. But marriage isn't just a two-way contract. You make a commitment to God in heaven who joins you together, not just with the other person. And so what does that mean? It means that God has called you to stay together for life. That's his plan. And I think about the rainbow. After the flood, God initiated a covenant with not just Noah, but really Noah and all of his descendants, where he says, I'm never again going to destroy the earth with water. So you may have some rainstorms that sometimes last a little bit longer than what you thought they should or would, but we don't have to worry about the rain going on and on and on until we have another great flood. God says, no, I'm never going to do that again. Now, how long is that good for? Is there a statute of limitations on that? No, God's authority says that as long as the earth stands from here to eternity, he is not going to do that again. When the earth is destroyed, it won't be with a flood. In the end, it will be with fire. But the point is that rainbow is a token of the covenant that every time we see it in the sky, we ought to be reminded of God's covenant promise, which is designed to last until the end of time. That's the nature of a covenant. By the way, the ring is supposed to be a token of the marriage covenant, just like the rainbow is a token of that promise and covenant that God made with mankind so many years ago. So, how does all this relate to symbolism of the covenant in a wedding ceremony? I just find this fascinating. Most weddings, you've got a center aisle, right? And typically, you find that you invite people to the wedding. Usually there's a formal invitation and it's a big deal. Who are we going to invite? And I don't know about you, but I find it fascinating that the first question you get asked by the usher when you walk into an assembly where there's going to be a wedding is, whose side are you on? Isn't that interesting? Are you here with the bride or the groom? And typically you sit, you know, the bride's guest on one side and the groom's on the other. And what happens is the best man and the preacher and the groom, they typically come out of a little side room there and then they wait for the bride to come down the center aisle. What's she doing? She's walking between the living sacrifices, those that have been an important part in their lives and that have been given this special invitation, and they have been invited to witness the exchanging of the vows. As they get closer and closer to the place where they stand with the preacher and where you utter the prayer and where you exchange your vows, see, it goes back to Genesis 15. It's all designed with this center aisle and the way it's set up to walk down through the living sacrifices. It's a covenant. And that's pictured in what you do at a wedding. I don't know about you, but that's totally new to me until 1994. And now every time I go to a wedding, I just think about that. Wow. This is a covenant. And that's why it is put together the way that it is. And what about the white runner? That's typically still done in a wedding. Well, why do you have a white runner? Well, because as you get closer and closer to the altar where you're going to exchange your vows before God, you're entering into holy matrimony. And so the idea is that you walk down this white runner to indicate that you're getting closer and closer to holy ground or holiness. That's where that comes from. All right, what else? Well, as I said, typically the groom enters first, along with the preacher and the best man. Why is that? Why does the groom enter first and then he waits for the bride to come down the aisle? Well, the importance of this is that the groom is to be the initiator of the covenant. God's plan is that the man makes the proposal, not the reverse. God's plan is that the man asks the girl out, not the reverse. We've kind of lost some of that in our culture, haven't we? The groom is to be the initiator. He is the one who has the greater responsibility because ultimately he is to be the head of his home. So he comes out first. And then typically what we have, of course, is the father walks the bride down the aisle. And please notice that the grandparents and the parents are an important part of this covenant ceremony, and everybody sits and watches while they are escorted to their very important seats of honor that are reserved for them. And wow, they are the ultimate living sacrifices, are they not? I mean, who had more to do with raising and getting this bride and groom to the place where they can be at this moment in their life and start this new family but the grandparents and the parents themselves? So no wonder they are given special seating. And the father's duty as the father is to keep his daughter pure. Check out Deuteronomy 21, 13 through 21. And he walks her down, hopefully, with a white dress, which, of course, we all know is to stand for moral purity. Shouldn't be just a fashion statement. Should indicate that I have protected my daughter in such a way that I'm telling you she is an untarnished gift. And that used to really have meaning. And how sad it is, and in so many people's minds, that's not even expected anymore. But you dads need to recognize your responsibility in protecting your daughter and keeping her pure. That's why they used to ask permission of the father to date the daughter, because you wanted the father's blessing and approval. That's important. We just talked in our class over at the Lens that one of the indicators that someone's going to be successfully married is the approval of the family and the friends. Now, somebody runs off against their parents' wishes because their parents don't approve of your choice. It's not a good way to start off a marriage. But what a wonderful thing if you understand you're not just marrying that person, but you're blending two families. And a part of that blending process as you become one is you're here together sharing in this covenant ceremony. Very, very important. All right, what else do we learn? Well, the father gives the bride away. Well, what is that all about? Well, this shows the full blessing of the parents. Typically, the statement is made, her father and I do, or something like that. Her mother and I do, excuse me. Well, that's right, because you want a statement indicating that we are putting faith in this groom to basically take over the role that the father has played in this bride's life. When my daughters were growing up, I was their pilot, their provider, and their protector. And I stand there, basically, at the wedding, and I tell the world that I am now taking those responsibilities and I am passing that authority and responsibility over to this groom. And what I'm thinking is, and you better not mess it up. Seriously, when my children were in my house, it was my responsibility to be their head, and they were in subjection to their mother and father. Now their primary responsibility is the wife is to be in submission to the husband, not the parents. It used to be that it was my primary responsibility to protect my daughters as the dad, and now I'm saying you are going to be the protector. Wow, that's an awesome moment when you're kind of passing that responsibility over. There's one part of this that I really like. My favorite part as a dad is that it used to be my responsibility to pay her bills. And now it's your responsibility to take care of her and to pay her bills. That's a part of leave and cleave, right? See, there's always mixed emotions when you talk about weddings. But that's what that's all about. That's why it's set up that way. It's very important, this transfer of authority over to the groom. And as I said, that ring is to be a token of this marriage covenant. You know, for many years, I used to hold up the ring and say some poetic language about how the ring is round and never-ending, just like your love should be never-ending, and it has gold and diamonds to indicate love's preciousness, and all this poetic stuff, all of which is well and good, but it's all secondary to the fact that this is supposed to tell the world that you belong to this other person. And this is supposed to be a reminder, a token, a witness of this new covenant relationship. It bothers me sometimes how many people are not serious about wearing their wedding rings. I mean, there may be some good reasons on some occasions, You ought to wear this ring and feel good about it and constantly be reminded of the covenant, not just how beautiful it looks. One of my favorite parts of a wedding is when you introduce the couple. It's now my pleasure for the first time anywhere before any audience to introduce unto you Mr. and Mrs., in the case of my daughter, who was Brad Sullins, and typically everybody claps and they walk down the aisle, and it's kind of a moment of celebration. What is that? That is where you are establishing a change of the names. Remember with the Abrahamic covenant, that's where Abram's name was changed to Abraham. Well, now in this marriage covenant, literally the wife takes on the name of the husband to indicate his leadership and that they are one as a family. It's also fascinating to me that spiritually, when we come forward and we confess our faith and we repent and we're baptized and we go through the believer's wedding ceremony, that's really what baptism is. It's really the point at which you make your commitment and exchange your vows, and then you come up out of that water or gave a baptism, a new creature, and now guess what? You have a new name. Now you're a Christian. You wear the name of Christ. It's the most important name you could ever possibly think about wearing. We ought to wear it with honor. And you couldn't wear that name until you finished going through the wedding ceremony. Don't you see how all of this is parallel? It's a part of being in covenant relationship with God. And that's a part of our wearing a new name in Christ. Now, why is it that typically when you come in, they have you sign a guest book? Well, I used to think it was so you could kind of line up the gifts and figure out who came and make sure you had your thank you notes just right. That is so shallow. Do you know when you go throughout history, it used to be that the guest book was at the reception. The reason was, is people used to understand that when you come into the wedding, you come in to witness the exchanging of the vows, and the signature there was you're signing on as a witness. Because the most important part of the wedding is not how the colors match and what kind of cake you have and all the fol-de-rol we tend to get involved in with now. The most important part is the vows and the witnesses. And so you'd sign the guest book at the reception. Now, typically, to make sure we don't miss anybody, you sign the guest book as you walk in. And when my daughters were married, I said, now, we already had you sign this when you came in, but I want you to consider your signature, a signature is a witness. And as a witness, I expect you to listen carefully to these vows and do everything you can to help this couple of which you've already had an important contribution in their life, or you wouldn't have been invited to the wedding, to continue your contribution to their lives by helping them keep their vows. In fact, when I do a wedding, I have the couple exchange their vows and make a commitment to one another, and then I face the audience and I say, now I've got a vow I want you to make. I want you to make a vow before God that you will help this couple succeed in their marriage, and if you ever see either one of them not doing what they should, that you'll call them out on it. Because what we need more than anything else is a support system for marriages, instead of this kind of sense of isolation where typically people have no idea what's going on until Humpty Dumpty's already fallen off the wall and it's too late. So I think that's a very important part of the ceremony. It used to be the norm. It's kind of been forgotten. I think that ought to be reinstituted. This idea of you are a witness and I expect you to take your witnessing of this wedding and these vows seriously. Before we talk about the receiving line, I'd like to tell you something that just fascinates me. I did a lot of research on divorce rates in other countries. And of course, as you know, back in the 1900s, divorce was almost unheard of in America. Very low divorce rate. Well, that's still true in lots of the world. In fact, are you aware that in Armenia, the divorce rate last couple of years was 0.4%. Wow. Again, almost unheard of. And so I started to investigate, well, why is it so low in some of these foreign countries? Well, one of the things they do, like in Armenia, is when the couple is brought together, they appoint, in their culture, they refer to it as godparents. And this is kind of an older couple that's supposed to mentor them. And if there's ever difficulty, let's assume you're in some Armenian village and you can tell the couple's arguing and all this kind of stuff, and you can hear that and you realize something's wrong, and so you call up the godparents. And the godparents immediately pack their bags, show up on the couple's doorstep, and say, "We understand you're having difficulty. We understand that sometimes couples have difficulties. We had difficulties, we worked through them, and we're here to help you work through yours. And we're not moving out until we're convinced that you're okay." And they are highly motivated, if for no other reason, to get their privacy back, to get their act together, and to work through that relationship problem. See, there's a support system. And frankly, there's a healthy stigma that divorce is not a good idea. I was in Hallmark stores a while back, and I was looking at the cards. I was so sad to see a section in Hallmark cards that you send people cards who are going through a divorce. And I said, "What? A divorce card?" And I picked up one of the cards and says, "I understand you're going through a divorce." You open it up and says, "Isn't it great to be back in circulation? Congratulations." I thought, how twisted is that? Congratulations on your divorce? Listen, even when a divorce is scriptural and there's a clear scriptural reason for it that is justified, it is still a very sad day, because no divorce ever occurs without some sin occurring. God's will is that you stay together until death do you part, not until divorce do you part. And I'm just fascinated by the fact that there are places in the world where they're just, generally speaking, in the culture, expected to fix this, work it out, instead of bail out so quickly. All right, what's the purpose of the receiving line? When I was younger, I thought it was so I'd get a chance to kiss the bride. You know, give her a little kiss on the cheek, you know. I remember that. That was nice. No, that's not what the receiving line is all about at all. Originally, the receiving line was designed so that you could give a blessing or a Bible verse or a short note or word of wisdom to the couple. And it's all now about physical things and wedding gifts and being on the registry. And I'm not saying there's not a practical value to that, but you know what? How valuable it would be if long-term successful married couples would really think about their life and their marriage and what pearl of wisdom they could give this young couple, and that they write that down and they give that to them on the at the receiving line. And they can save those notes and those prayers and those well wishes and put them together and remember that. It's the way it used to be, folks. We've lost that. I think we got to get those kind of things back and ask couples to give words of advice and blessing. Look at the marriage of Ruth and Boaz. That's kind of what seems to be going on. The people there at the wedding are giving God's blessings to this couple. And if we understand that this relationship is primarily spiritual, it will make a huge difference. And why is there almost always food at the reception? Well, this is the covenant celebration. Jesus, of course, in his day, they went to wedding feast, right? And it's always been that after the covenant, you rejoice. What happens after a scriptural baptism when you take on this covenant with Jesus and you take on his name? You go on your way like the eunuch, what? Rejoicing. And after that, what do you then benefit in? Every Sunday with the rest of your spiritual family, the feast of the Lord's Supper. It's only designed for people who are in covenant relationship with the Lord. And so again, that's what the reception is. It is the covenant celebration. And why is it that typically you find that the couple at the end has this photo shot where you feed cake to each other? I thought that was, you know, just some sort of shot. So typically, you know, they put it in each other's face and everybody laughs. And it's a good photo shoot. Where'd that tradition come from? Well, the idea is simply it's symbolizing becoming one. What's mine is yours. What's yours is mine. We're one together in this relationship. It's exactly the same idea as 1 Corinthians 11, where we're told when we partake together in the fruit of the vine and in the unleavened bread, the body and the blood, that we do that and we become one in the body and the blood as we all partake of the same supper. Isn't that fascinating how all of these things are parallel? Because they're both dealing with covenants, a concept that our culture is almost totally lost. After I learned this, as I said, it just opened up a whole new vista of appreciation as to what's involved in a wedding ceremony. So when I do a wedding ceremony, I take the time to explain to everybody what this all means and what it's about, and how this primarily is a spiritual union, and we are witnessing God joining them together, and you are witnesses, and we expect you to help this marriage be successful. It is not just some social, civil ceremony. It has that aspect to it. But I believe it is designed by God to be primarily a sacred, spiritual covenant, and I, for one, want to get back to holy matrimony. Time to take a break. Let's take 5 minutes, and then we'll come back, and we will see what we can do to apply some of these principles to our own marriages, okay? So remember, get up, walk around, enjoy visiting, and we'll be back in about 5 minutes. Thanks, you.